Coming to you from the Outer Mission, this is Monkey Block, a storytelling podcast focused on San Francisco's golden past, 1849 through 1906. I'm your host, Girlina. The stories are closely based on newspapers of the time, historical books, and journals. Disclaimer, I do my best to research and share the real stories, extracting legends or calling them out. Now, let's go back in time. Dear listeners, I'm back from the San Francisco Historical Society presentation. That was 3 episodes worth of research, with the added work of creating slides for my script. I won't lie, it was a lot of effort, but I'm proud of what I ultimately presented. I was sufficiently nervous, and the unexpected technical difficulties did not help. But I challenged myself to do something unfamiliar, and hey, I live to tell. The Society selects 11 speakers a year, and I was one of them. I was not aware that they were trying something new, starting with me. I am not a trained historian or an expert on this topic, but I exhibit a passion for San Francisco's history. They want to begin hosting new speakers with varying backgrounds who can present San Francisco's history in a new way to their existing and hopefully new audience. I didn't do as well as I could have during the questions section because honestly, I was nervous. Of course, I know about whaling ships and their touch points to Yerba Buena trading. I've discussed merchant and whaling ships how many times in my episodes? I wasn't as fast on my feet as I could have been. Today's episode is the audio from the presentation. I removed the spots where technical difficulties occurred. I apologize for the audio quality, the ringing cell phones, and the clunky edits. It's not the sound quality I usually provide on my podcast, but sometimes you get what you get, especially when it's recorded live. If you want to see the slides that accompanied the presentation, search YouTube for the San Francisco Historical Society and locate the presentation on smuggling in Yerba Buena, September 13th, 2022. Some of the names and information will sound familiar if you have listened to previous episodes. And speaking of, today's episode, the presentation, is an hour long. Today is the day if you have ever wished for a longer episode. And one more thing. They introduce me by my real name. It's a pleasure to meet you, dear listeners. I'm Carlina, your podcast host, Girlina. Now, on with the show. I'd like to welcome everyone who's here live. Thank you for being here, as well as everyone who is online. A little bit about me. I'm an amateur San Francisco historian. I'm born and raised in the Bay Area. And my family history starts in the Mission District with my parents, who immigrated here separately and actually met on Dolores Street. And they lived in the Mission just up until I was born. During the dot-com boom, I was putting myself through college by bartending at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, which is now the Four Seasons. And at the time, that was San Francisco's only 5-star hotel. And this is when I became interested in this part of San Francisco, after realizing the similarities between the dot-com boom and the gold rush. This area was ground zero for both events, and I was personally witnessing one of them happening, from at least the hospitality side. After years of informal research, during the second shelter in place, I decided to put that curiosity into a podcast, and then here I am. And speaking of my podcast, preparing for a live talk is really different than preparing an episode where I record alone in my room with editing software. I'm going to try not to talk too fast, and I'm going to try not to get tongue-tied because I don't have my editing software for do-overs. So I'll start my program the way I start my episodes, and that is to say, coming to you live from the San Francisco Historical Society, this is Monkey Block, a storytelling podcast Based on San Francisco's golden past, I'm your host, Carlina, and tonight's program is about smuggling and the connection to our beloved Yerba Buena. Disclaimer, I do my best to tell the real stories, eliminating legend or calling them out. Now, let's go back in time. So early in my research, I realized the term smuggling alone was not going to retrieve the information that I was looking for. I was chasing information about an activity people do not openly admit to participating in. Tax evaders don't usually admit to avoiding taxes, especially in official documents, and that's usually where I do my research. When smuggling was captured in official documents or books, the authors were strongly encouraged to reword, soften, or remove the reference to the illegal activity if the guilty or their close descendants were still alive. Smuggling was always illegal in California, with a lowercase L in various degrees and various locations. Lyft, Uber, and Airbnb were mostly legal when they started, so that cavalier attitude is something we've always embraced. The challenge was gathering intentionally hidden information and about a very specific area. I had to look for discrete clues, subtle references and documents, personal and official letters and diaries. And tonight I cover a really large period of time from the 1770s to the 1840s. So I can only touch on the surface of various topics. So here are some other search terms I had to use. Contraband trade, contrabando, illegal trade, illegal commerce, illicit trade, illicit commerce, unsanctioned trading, buccaneering, clandestine trade. We'll never know the total volume or total dollars of smuggled goods because it wasn't well captured in accounting books, if at all, to protect the guilty. And negotiation is an art form. It's a specific skill. And smuggling was considered a type of negotiation. It was a dance between the legal and the illegal, and your profit is based on your negotiation skills. This was a gentlemanly sport. You displayed your savvy in knowing when and how far to push during the negotiation and when to change course if it wasn't going well, so you didn't land in prison. So let's start by laying the foundation for the art of smuggling and the connection to Yerba Buena. The path to smuggling might not be as direct as you think. The backstory. On October 23rd, 1775, a 240-person caravan departs from Sonora, New Spain, current-day southern Arizona, and they travel 1,700 miles to a northern point in Alta California. And they plan to secure land for Spain's newest outpost to do a mission in a presidio north of Monterey and near the St. Francisco Harbor. This path does not have roads to accommodate wagons, so they travel by foot with horses and mules and cattle, pulling their supplies and belongings. And 5 months after starting the expedition, Padre Pedro Font locates what he believes should be Spain's next outpost. March 28, 1776, he writes, "The port of San Francisco is a model of nature and may well be called the harbor of harbors, and I think if it could be well settled like Europe, there would not be anything more beautiful in all the world." And he says a few other things, but he ends with, "in which may be established shipyards, docks, and anything that may be wished." And he was correct. On October 8th or 9th, history's not sure, 1776, the mission San Francisco de Assis is founded. This area was not discovered during this expedition. A community of people already inhabited this area and had a name for it. Those are the Ramai Toshaloni, and they call the area Yalamu. And I'm speaking about the Ramai Toshaloni in the present tense because they are still alive, and that's how they wish to be referenced. And I also want to acknowledge the complicated dynamics with the missions and the legacy of the mission system on the original inhabitants that remains even today. All right, so a little bit of geography. Alta California included all of current day California, Nevada, and Utah, and then parts of Arizona, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. And for this talk, when I say Alta California, I'm going to mean current day Northern, Central, and Southern California, which ends at San Diego. Baja California starts below San Diego, was and still is a peninsula in current day Mexico, despite being named Baja California. And then San Blas, that's the government center at the time, and it's on the mainland of New Spain, Mexico, and that was the main port of entry for Spain. And so on here,
Note how far Alta California is from San Blas, the government center, and then also note how far San Francisco is from the government center, because that might turn into a problem. So early on, the missions were trading surplus agriculture with the Spanish military out of absolute necessity. Spain was having trouble transporting the promised 2 supply ships a year to Baja and Alta California for the people building and establishing the missions and the presidios in their name. When supplies arrived, they first went to the military, then to the padres, and then the native inhabitants were factored in after that. Spain realizes trading is happening between the soldiers and the padres, so the government determines it's in their interest to set the prices on the traded items to benefit the military. So Spain sets low trading prices for the wheat, corn, hemp, and hides and tallow the padres are trading with the Spanish military. On top of the imbalanced trading structure, Spain also forbids the padres from trading with anyone except the Spanish government. The padres are naturally unhappy with the set low prices and the restrictions around who they can trade with, since absolute necessity is the reason for the trading. The situation for the Californios changes in the wrong direction when Spain declares war on Great Britain and experiences financial trouble. The Alta California soldiers, the padres, and the native labor continue building the missions in Carmel, San Diego, San Gabriel, and San Antonio without pay. And the Spanish supply ships aren't showing up as promised. Unable to pay their soldiers with currency they no longer have, Spain begins paying the soldiers in credit at the missions and the Presidio stores. The padres at the missions now play a bigger role in the trading system. Each soldier has an account created in their name, and as the soldier works, credit is added to their account, and credit is deducted when the soldier buys supplies from the padre-managed stores. This system works as long as Spain provides credit and supplies are available to purchase on credit. The padres, though, regardless of the incoming ships, can continue farming, except one mission. San Francisco has undeniable issues with farming due to the poor weather and the sandy soil. But something changes again. In an effort to expedite the supply ships to Baja and Alta California, Spain decides to bypass the Spanish Royal Commissary in Spain, sending the supply ships first to San Blas, then arriving in Monterrey, unannounced. By bypassing the Royal Commissary, the supplies are arriving in San Blas without prices. And that puts pressure on San Blas to quickly create prices for all the supplies, which actually winds up delaying the supply delivery. But worse than the delay in San Blas, they are adding inflated prices to the supplies headed for Baja and Alta California distribution. And the Californios are not amused with the inflated prices or the delayed delivery, but I'm sure San Blas was fine with pocketing the extra income. Alta California missions and presidios, that's anything north of San Diego, has a harder time getting supplies delivered because of the winds heading towards Monterrey. And not many ships want to make this difficult voyage, so they don't. Between 1788 and 1796, only 2 Spanish supply ships venture up the Alta California coast past San Diego, with prices inflated by 50%. The promised arrangement was 2 supply ships a year, but now Alta California receives 2 supply ships in 8 years. And to add insult to injury, for a period, the supplies being delivered were cigars. The military was getting paid in cigars. Historically, it was the padres who suffered from the imbalanced trading structure, but now, especially in Alta California, past Monterrey, it's the padres, the soldiers, and their families who are suffering in equal measure. And the natives, they continue to come in last. Out of necessity, Alta California has an early incentive to find a way to solve this worsening supply chain problem. Being furthest from San Blas makes it harder north of San Diego and Monterrey, but San Francisco Harbor is furthest from San Blas. As stated earlier, the San Francisco outpost yields the least amount of produce and is the last on the distribution route. But something is silently changing. In 1796, we have one known smuggling vessel from Boston, Realistically, there were others, but this is the one that history can verify. When the American Revolution started, Boston merchant ships got locked out of trading in the West Indies, so they concentrate their trading efforts on the West Coast of South, Central, and North America, and the English are equally as interested in trading with the same market. Absolute necessity creates the beginning of the smuggling trade in Las Californias. Alta California is hungrier than Baja to fix the existing issue, and San Francisco is especially hungry. Everyone is suffering, including the governor of Alta California. He tells a Russian visitor, "It grieves me to tell you, but it is actually true that our government is too slow and therefore has no accurate conception of anything, nor has it any desire to acquire any." If Spain had the resources to consistently supply Las Californias at reasonable prices, there wouldn't be a need to develop illicit trading. They would continue with the credit system at the missions for a longer period of time. For Alta Californias to fix this issue, they need a highly desired, locally sourced good for trading with the incoming ships, something that they can easily produce in large numbers. Enter the first phase of smuggling, for sea otter pelts. It's not until 1800 that Spanish authorities are alerted of an American smuggling ship, which confirmed what the Spanish had suspected for a long while, which also means that Spain was clearly unaware of the Boston ships 4 years earlier. News traveled a lot slower back then, or people were just better at keeping secrets. It's worth mentioning the 1795 International Maritime Law, allowing ships to anchor in forbidden ports if their ship is badly beaten, out of drinking water or provisions, or their crew is very ill. By 1803, several Boston and English captains find themselves in desperate need to anchor off the Alta California coast because their crew is very ill, they're out of water. In that year, 28 ships from England and Boston visit California for sea otter belts. And that is the known number of ships in 1 year. Just imagine how many ships we don't know about. Ships are now boldly trading along the Pacific coast with very eager traders. But why sea otter pelts? They have over 600,000 hair follicles per square inch, no blubber, because they have water-resistant fur for insulation. And that makes their fur well-suited for winter clothing, like hats and jackets or decoration on royal robes. Sea otters were hunted in the hundreds and sometimes thousands at a time. Pelts can sell for up to $100 each, and they are very desirable in China. The padres, the military, and the native inhabitants are grateful for the foreign traders providing survival necessities at literally half the price offered by their own government. It's now 1804, and Spain no longer has the naval power or finances to protect the Alta or Baja coast or any coast. The presidios are decaying, and the cannons are inoperable. And by no surprise, the stationed military are displeased with their government. Without military barriers preventing visiting ships, illicit trading flourishes. And the Californios aren't discouraging their arrival, because why would they? Their survival depends on them. Spain makes a royal order in vain, refusing entry of all foreign ships from anchoring at all official ports in Las Californias. And there was a key word in what I just said. Alta California military, having been neglected for so long, are no longer willing to protect the shores from the ships carrying the very supplies that they need. And the padres, they are now savvy traders with the incoming smuggling ships. The foreign ships start anchoring in unofficial ports. Problem solved. So now, where in Alta California is there a year-round protected harbor, maybe a cove, that is also an unofficial port? You can't go to San Diego, and you can't go to Monterey, because those are official ports of entry. The San Francisco Presidio is kind of an official port, but there must be something. Maybe something close to where we are right now. Ships start using Yerba Buena Cove. It's a year-round protected, unofficial port, and it's out of plain sight from the ocean. A few known examples of trading during this time, which may have included Yerba Buena Cove, it's hard to know, but it's hard to deny. In 1804, in 1805, the Boston ship Layla Bird successfully trades with California missions. Between 1806 and 1813, another Boston ship, Mercury, was extensively trading along the California coast with the missions, ranchers, and natives. You just avoided official ports of entry. This was an easy transition for the English and New England traders since they have been smuggling in the Caribbean. And at this moment, there aren't duties to pay, it's all profit, and a lot of open secrecy about smuggling. The new power dynamic in Alta California trading is solidified. The military is trading with the missions, and the ships are trading with the missions, and the missions, meaning the padres, have become central to the trading community. When Spain attempts to gain control over sea otter trading, the missions, now the main trading posts, openly refused to follow orders, and as previously mentioned, the military has stopped defending the coast. And now I'd like to open it up to questions on what I've said so far. The gentleman in the second row.
I've lost it. Thank you.
This isn't a question, but it's a comment. This is fascinating. And I'm just overwhelmed at your research and what you present that we did not know, were never taught, and probably never even suspected was going on in our history. So that's not a question, it's a comment and a statement of appreciation.
Thank you.
Carlina and I have had this conversation, and I was the same thing, and I had lots of Catholic schooling, so, and Angus knows his early San Francisco history, so that's a huge compliment.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Is there another question? Yes.
How did the whaling trade interact with this?
You know what? I didn't spend time on whaling. I mean, there were whaling ships, but I didn't factor it into my research tonight. Fair question, though.
Okay. Yeah. All right. My suspicions of the whaling is much further north, but I'm not sure about that. Angus, do you know?
Well, it probably went back to New England with what they captured,
because there's no place. Sure. Sure. Yeah, they're dealing on the high seas, so they're not necessarily, but they got to make port once in a while, and they got to have something they can trade, so nobody wants their blubber. Right. All right. Question over here.
What were they bringing? I mean, were they bringing agricultural goods, food, you know, fruits, wine? I don't know. What were they bringing to trade for the pelts?
That is a very good question, and I will get into that. Very good question.
Stay tuned. All right, any other questions? We got one here.
I guess I didn't quite understand. I think what you said was that the missions were basically in charge and that the military went along because they weren't in charge of protecting anything anymore. Is that what you were saying?
They weren't willing to protect anything anymore. Their government had failed them.
None of these people, they were saying to Spain, you know, you can go take it and jump in the lake.
Yep. Pound sand, Spain.
And Spain had no, unless you get into it, they had no recourse?
No, they had none.
California, they did not know, had gold. I mean, they'd taken it from the Aztecs and they've taken it from everybody else. So this was not a highly desirable place in the Spanish world, and the Mexicans now are into this as well. This is not great pickings.
Yeah, not at this point, not yet.
All right, ready to move on?
Let's go. Oh, does this gentleman in the front have a question?
We have one more.
Yeah, my question was the need for defense of the coast. Was there any other... was there other military actions like the Russians or the English?
No, those were
problems at all.
No, we were trading with them, so we're not going to tell them not to show up.
So the military just faded away.
Oh no, they had no intention of protecting their shores from people bringing the supplies they needed.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Moving on.
So things were improving up until something changes again. In 1808, the Spanish king is captured and imprisoned by France, and now all the money and even the cigars are gone. Even Baja California and the rest of New Spain, including Mexico, start to suffer. In 1810, the last Spanish supply ship arrives in the San Francisco Bay, 1810. And also in 1810, the Mexican War of Independence begins. Colonial Mexico is now at war with Spain, and even if Spain wants to, they can't bring their ships to Baja or Alta California. And colonial Mexico, being involved in a war, is too busy to send supply ships to either of the Californias. Or, said another way, nothing changes for Alta California or San Francisco. And at this moment, with Spain and colonial Mexico busy at war, no one is watching Alta California. So ships from Lima, Peru, captained by foreign traders from Russia, New England, England, and France start arriving in Alta California for sea otter trading. And through sea otter trading, things in Alta California are finally improving up until 1820, when the sea otter trade suddenly stops. And you can probably take a few good guesses what happens. Sea otters were nearly hunted into extinction. But what else do we have in abundance? Recall the horses, mules, and cattle from the Anza expedition? As luck would have it, the majority of California is well-suited for feeding and raising cows, so their population increases without much effort, and the cows roam openly and everywhere in Alta California. The missions and the rancheros had been producing hide and tallow for themselves, but now find an opportunity to trade the now very sought-after Alta California hide and tallow with incoming ships. The cowhide leather was the more profitable item, and it was in great demand for shoes, saddles, belts, bags, and bags to hold the tallow. And the tallow, while not as lucrative as hide, was also sought after. And there's two layers of fat that were on the cow. There's the manteca, the lard, that's the fat nearest to the hide, and that was considered better quality, and that was usually kept here and used locally for cooking. While the sebo, the interior fat, that's what was traded, and that was used to make candles and soap and used as a lubricant for mills and other machinery. So the sebo fat is the tallow in the hide and tallow trade. And it's just as well because it gives the sea otters a chance to repopulate. Alta California trading, smuggling, buccaneering enters into the hide and tallow phase. You just don't use official ports of entry. The future is getting brighter in Alta California thanks to cows. And I'm sure many of you in this room probably already know that the cow hides were valuable enough to be used as currency and are nicknamed California banknotes. But no one's using tallow for currency. Alta California is finally doing well. And Yerba Buena Cove is doing whatever Yerba Buena Cove is doing, flying under the radar. But not everyone is celebrating. On January 16, 1820, the Mexican government hears about the arbitrary acts of the padres and their excess in buying goods for speculation, which are pretended to be for the missions. They're shipping liquor and other merchandise under the title of gifts, and the government insists that they must pay their 6 1/4 tax like all other persons. The government sends very sharp letters to the padres discussing their smuggling operations. And based on history, nothing comes out of these sharp letters because the padres continue trading. In 1821, Mexico wins independence from Spain and changes the trading laws, now allowing for legal foreign trade. And that's great news, except, like Spain, Mexico does not show interest in developing or supporting a very remote and very out of sight Alta California. And the San Francisco mission is still in the same situation. But being overlooked, being furthest from the government center, isn't new to the San Francisco mission. Alta California missions, ranchers, and residents already have a few established ways of dealing with the trading difficulties. You just don't trade at official ports of entry. So this next phase in Alta California trading takes a surprising turn based on what I've said so far. One of my podcast listeners, who lives in southern England, sent me an email describing how he came across my hide and tallow episode as he was researching his family history. And we communicated back and forth, usually me at 6:30 in the morning. I realized that there was a California trading storyline that I was not aware of that directly relates to tonight's topic in an unexpected way. So we would email back and forth discussing our research. I went to the California Historical Society, and he traveled 3 hours each way to the British Library. As I helped the dear listener research his family history, he helped me research for tonight's program, and for that, I am extremely thankful. I also was able to utilize his blog with collected information and transcribed letters dedicated to his family history. The next phase in trading is McCullough Hartnell and Company. So like other foreign traders, Hugh McCullough and William Hartnell are living in Lima, Peru, and they're working as clerks for a Scottish merchant company called the John Begg and Company, owned by John Begg. In 1821, Monsieur Hugh McCullough becomes aware that Mexico, having won independence from Spain, has loosened their foreign trading restrictions in the Californias. I believe McCullough comes up with a genius business plan and presents it to William Hartnell. And the idea is to capitalize on the growing California trade business and focus on hide and tallow. But that's not the unique or interesting part, though. McCullough's idea is for he and Hartnell to act as hide and tallow trading agents for John Begg and Company. The hide will be procured for England to make shoes and other leathered goods, and the tallow will go to South America for soap and candles. But hide is their main focus because it's the more profitable item. McCullough and Hartnell plan to utilize John Begg's many ships to routinely trade at all the California harbors and bays from San Diego to San Francisco. Upon arrival, the idea is to first speak with the Mexican government to receive official permission before approaching the missions. And next is the unique part. They plan to ask the missions to voluntarily enter into an exclusive 3-year hide and tallow trading contract with McCullough, Hartnell, and Company. And the other unique part? They plan to do this legally. In mid-1822, McCullough and Hartnell take a huge chance by stocking a ship with $22,000 in clothing, shawls, buttons, combs, cooking utensils, dishes, cocoa, a lot of things. And they set sail for Alta California. Now, this is a 2 to 3 month voyage, and these men aren't even sure if their unique plan is going to be met with smiles or scowls. An exclusive trading contract with the missions with government permission has never been done before. McCullough and Hartnell arrive in Monterey in June 1822 with letters of recommendation, and they first meet with Governor Sola and then Father Payeres, and they propose their unique business plan. The officials politely listen to the gentlemen and their novel business proposal, and they love the idea so much that they start selling the idea to the missions before McCullough and Hartnell even have a chance to speak to the padres. Sola and Payeres present it to the missions as an opportunity that we have been waiting for. In that moment, the ship John Begg becomes Alta California's first welcomed, and that is to say legal, foreign trading ship by port authority. And up here, I have the plaque to where they, McCullough and Hartnell, had built their first hide house in San Pedro, which actually went on to influence the creation of the Port of Los Angeles. Entering into this 3-year contract is voluntary, but it is an exclusive trading contract if a mission decides to enter. And it's exclusive from the missions to McCullough and Hartnell, but I don't believe it's exclusive from McCullough and Hartnell to the missions. The missions are excited because this guarantees regular ships to trade with for guaranteed 3 years, and that's a huge improvement. And it also provides the missions with a consistent customer for their hide and tallow at fixed prices rather than the inconsistent trading and ship arrivals under the blanket of secrecy. And another huge benefit, this is sanctioned by their government. There's no more secrecy. Each mission will be asked to individually sign a contract. So McCullough and Hartnell divide and conquer from Monterey. And I want to remind you that the padres, by this point, have become savvy traders as the central point in trading with the inhabitants and the ships. So McCullough travels south from Monterey to pitch this business plan to the missions, and he has a harder time getting each mission to enter into this agreement, but he is ultimately successful with each mission south of Monterey. Hartnell has much better luck with the missions north of Monterey, likely because the contract guarantees what the northern part of California has been lacking for 4 decades. Or I don't know, maybe Hartnell's just a better businessman. Out of the 22 missions, all the missions, except 2, enter into this agreement. The San Rafael and the San Francisco mission do not sign the contract. And the reason given was the missions were still in a state of construction, and we aren't sure we have anything to trade. Those two missions use that same excuse for a lot of other things. I believe it has more to do with the already established backdoor trading where unofficial ports like Yerba Buena Cove have been in use. And I also believe it's the exclusivity of this contract that wasn't to their liking. And again, my opinion based on what I've read. But why do I believe that? Well, the Mission San Francisco and San Rafael don't sign the contract. They do trade with McCullough and Hart now. And how do I know that? When I went to the California Historical Society, I saw Hartnell's original accounting books from 1823 to 1827, and the dear listener, who is the distant cousin of Hugh McCullough, researched the day books and Hartnell's letters left for posterity. Let's take a look. So this is from April 10th, 1823. Here's a photo I took. And this is where McCullough and Hartnell trade with the government of San Francisco. See quite a few items. On that same day, here is trading that they did with the Mission San Francisco. And you also see Ignacio Pacheco and Antonio de Valle on there. And, cruising through this. And here's another Mission of San Francisco sale. Also Mission Santa Clara and Mission Santa Cruz. So McCullough and Hartnell are known in Alta California as McCullough y Hartnell. McCullough is the supercargo managing the commercial matters for the business, and he's the one traveling back and forth. And Hartnell is the California resident manager for the firm staying on site in Monterey. The government embraces McCullough y Hartnell and gives them land to build a store and a warehouse in San Pedro, which they quickly move to Monterey. And this is an 1853 drawing of the land designations given to them, even though this was given to them in 1820. And yes, it says yards, not varas, but it says 16 by 100 yards, 50 by 100 yards, 50 yards by 100 yards. And unlike other foreign traders who can only legally anchor in San Diego or Monterey, McCullough and Hartnell are given special privileges by the government to set up a warehouse and stores all along the Alta California coast. They pay the government established lower duties from the custom agents, and they are given permission to trade at every port and every bay near a mission, not just the official or unofficial ports. McCullough and Hartnell sell directly to William Richardson, Mariano Vallejo, Nathan Spear, Juan Batista Alvarado, Jose Sanchez. The business is mostly successful, but they do have some challenges. Padres complained about McCullough and Hartnell's prices being too high compared to the prices offered by other traders. If McCullough and Hartnell are legally doing business and fully paying duties and taxes, their prices are going to be higher than the other traders who come in through the back door without paying duties and taxes. And recall, Mission San Francisco and San Rafael do not enter into the contract and keep their trading options open. The other traders, mostly Bryant and Sturgis Company, become McCullough and Hartnell's biggest competition. But their business is a mixture of licit and illicit trading and is a distant second in trading volume compared to McCullough and Hartnell's licit business. And that, to me, is proof that McCullough and Hartnell's venture was successful. Bryant and Sturgis were a well-established trading company who disappointingly arrived in Alta California 2 weeks after a newly created McCullough and Hartnell and Company arrived. Things could have turned out very different for McCullough and Hartnell had they arrived after a big name like Bryant and Sturgis. Some background. Bryant and Sturgis started in sea otter trading as early as 1811, and by 1822, they transitioned their business to the more profitable hide and tallow trade, and they had visited California many times. But McCullough and Hartnell, the new kids in town, stole the hide and tallow thunder from a well-established company. McCullough and Hartnell had an additional advantage with the government. During Mexico's earliest years of independence, they generated reliable and greatly needed revenue. Alta Californians have expensive taste and they want the finer things from around the world. And at this point, they can afford it. And this, by the way, is the Lady Blackwood, which is a ship that sailed to the California coast during this time. By 1826, the exclusive 3-year contract is coming to an end, and the accounting ledgers capture some changes. We have fewer sales to missions, and either the missions were less willing to trade at the prices offered through the contract, or maybe the contract was ending and there was less to trade. I don't know. We see increased sales to individuals and governments, increased sales to miscellaneous sundry items, and then we have increased sales to cash that don't even name who you're selling to. And here's a cash sale in San Francisco. And now I'd like to open it up to questions.
Add one little thing. The mission system has collapsed by this time anyway. You know, between the high death rate of the local mission converts, shall we call them? They're dying out rapidly. The whole system is collapsed anyway. So that's kind of your answer for that answer. So, we got questions. You coming around? Go.
During this time, California just had an agricultural society. The economy was based pretty much on what they could trade with the traders. Were manufactured goods brought in to any extent? They could only send out so many boots and shoes and belts, but like machinery or products.
They were bringing in instruments. Clothing. As far as machinery goes, gosh, those were kind of
big and
heavy.
You'd have to get plows and that kind of stuff if you're going to start doing agricultural things. So, yeah, that's got to fit in there someplace. They're in those ledgers, I'm sure.
Yeah, I just didn't happen to take photos of those pages.
Right. All right, I think we can, if you're ready, we can move on.
Okay. Yep. Okay. All right. So the exclusive contract ends. South America, and that's specifically Buenos Aires, starts hide and tell a production of their own. Juan Ignacio Mancisador and Mr. Anderson become McCullough and Hartnell's hide and tell competition in Lima, Peru, which is their company headquarters, their backyard. John Begg, still located in Lima, decides importing California hide and tallow is no longer a profitable venture, and McCullough and Hartnell business, despite having a good run, folds in 1828. McCullough and Hartnell Company, despite having their 3-year contract with emissions from January 1st, 1823 through December 31st, 1825, their trading business did continue for a short while after the contract, and then they finally do fold in May 1828. But the remarkable part of this history is that licit trading creates the foundation for the strong return to Alta California's illicit trading. The warehouses and customers that McCullough and Hartnell left behind were quickly utilized by other traders. The missions can now freely trade with anyone at lower prices now the exclusive trading contract has ended. And suddenly, Bryant and Sturgis are doing very well with Alta California trading. The good times only last for a moment, though. After McCullough and Hartnell's company folded, the government-imposed taxes and duties were initially reasonable, but Mexico quickly increases the duties beyond anything that would allow for profit. The duties could be up to 100%, if not more, than what the products themselves could sell for. And I'm not clear why that was considered a viable plan, but the reason the Mexican government gave was the need to help with the financial hardships Mexico was facing. Now we have a smuggler's dilemma. The demand for imported goods is high, but the punishment, if you are caught, would mean the confiscation of your ship and the contraband on board, as well as jail time. But the risk-reward assessment, smugglers usually decide the potential profit is worth the risk. And here's a quick related story. Michael White, also known as Miguel Blanco, he's an Englishman, and he arrives in San Francisco Bay, either 1828 or 1829 on the Dolly, and please note, Yerba Buena is still just a cove, it's not a pueblo, and still just an unofficial port of entry, well-suited for illicit trading. Captain White first lands in San Francisco to trade a barrel of whiskey for 2 otter pelts. But before heading to Monterey, White has his crew conceal their most expensive items on board the ship, where they cannot easily be discovered. Then White sails down to Monterey and describes his experience at the Monterey Custom House. Jose Castro, a customs officer, comes on board the Dolly to ensure smuggling isn't happening. And it's a good thing Whitehead hid the expensive goods and left the cheaper items out for inspection. As soon as the search was done, Castro says to White, "Well, mi capitán, with the little the government gives me and the little that you give me, we'll make a pretty good salary, won't it be so?" White said on that day that they understood each other. Castro never saw me smuggle. Whenever I had anything of that kind to do, he went down into the cabin and attacked a bottle of liquor. Jose Castro, our bribable customs agent, would go on to become the governor of Baja and then the governor of Alta California.
Oh!
Who'd have thought? So here's just a moment I'm going to take to talk about a few of the different ways people smuggled. And they're in order from my least to my most favorite. So bribery is the least interesting. But, you know, there's skill involved. It's a delicate and polite way of asking the inspector at the right time and for the right price to look the other way without offending them. You come in too low with your bribe and you could find yourself in jail for insulting the agent. Hidden items. Clever but predictable. You take a barrel that is stuffed in the middle with more expensive light items like maybe silk, scarves, or handkerchiefs, and then you put loaves of bread at either end of the barrel and then seal up the barrel. So when the inspector looks, it doesn't matter which end he opens it up from, he's going to see loaves of bread. You could do what Michael White did, which is create hiding places on your ship by creating fake walls on the sides of the ship and on the floors. The shuffle, logistically creative, but sounds like a lot of work. Ship A would pull into port and pay their duties on their merchandise, and then at night travel out a little bit. And then in the night, Ship B would come to Ship A and move their expensive merchandise. And then in the morning, they would come into the port and pay a reduced fee. And then at night, they would go back to Ship A and get their expensive merchandise. Another plan, the Farallon Islands were used for this, was before you anchor, you leave your merchandise and a watch person at a nearby island, and then you anchor in port and pay a reduced tax, and then you go back to the island and get your watch person and your merchandise. Tied for my favorite distraction, when the inspector came on board, you would have the band start to play, and you'd start singing and dancing, bring out the liquor on one side of the ship, and then as the ruckus was happening over here, you'd have your crew start offloading the merchandise from the other side of the ship. The delay, I don't know, I think this one's actually my favorite. When the inspector arrives on the ship, you tell the inspector, the captain's a little busy, but if you go down into the cabin, he'll be with you shortly. Help yourself to the brandy and the cigars, and there's a comfy bed there too. After an hour, you go and check on the inspector's happy status, and depending on what you see, the captain is still busy, but please keep drinking. And you continue with this until you see that the inspector is in a pleasant mood to do business before bringing the captain. And this is essentially what Captain White agreed to plan was with Jose Castro. I'm going to make yerba buena the last part of my talk, even though there's still so much to say about smuggling. It's not until 1835 that William Richardson convinces the Mexican government to settle Yerba Buena Cove and the surrounding area as a pueblo. And that's to support the already existing commerce that's been coming and going from this unofficial port of entry. And while it's true, Yerba Buena was not well populated, that does not reflect the commerce that was regularly occurring there, or here. So given all of that backstory, the establishment of the Pueblo de Yerba Buena makes a lot of sense. Richardson becomes the first settler in Yerba Buena and is appointed the captain of the Yerba Buena Harbor. And since the Pueblo was created to support the existing commerce, they make this area more hospitable by creating a hotel, a bar, a blacksmith shop, a hide store. Jacob Primer Lees is the second or possibly the third Yerba Buena settler, and he opens up a merchandise store with Nathan Spear and William Sturgis Hinckley to support the trading business. And Juana Priones, the second or the third resident, has her dairy and produce farm just outside of Yerba Buena proper. Richardson supports himself with hide and tallow trade, using two schooners to move goods and merchandise from the various ranchos around the bay and then back to the cove. For reference, Yerba Buena Cove and then the landfill. So let's take a look at some of the people that were smuggling. or doing unsanctioned trading. The Padres and the Rancheros, Frederick Beachy, captain of the HMS Blossom, he's a naval officer and explorer. George Washington Ears, captain of the Mercury that I mentioned earlier. Richard Henry Dana, who writes 2 years before the mast, actually was asked to soften and remove language that indicated smuggling, so we had to soften what he said in his book. William Heath Davis Jr. is a second-generation smuggler. His father was a well-known smuggler. Henry Fitch, up until he became a customs agent. Thomas Larkin, who went on to become an American consul in Alta California. David Spence, who actually worked with Hartnell during the 3-year contract, was a smuggler. Alpheus Basil Thompson, imprisoned once for smuggling before he establishes his hide house at what would become Thompson's Cove in Yerba Buena. William Richardson. Mariano Guadalupe Vallejo, the largest landowner in northern Alta California and a government official. William Sturgis Hinckley, who is a relative of the Sturgis behind the Bryant and Sturgis Trading Company. He was actually imprisoned twice for smuggling before becoming the alcalde of the Pueblo of Yerba Buena. There was a half-hearted attempt to stop smuggling in Yerba Buena. November 1827, the Alta California governor wanted the construction of a guardhouse on the Yerba Buena beach to be occupied by a corporal and 3 soldiers. Bernard Duhout Sealy and his guards were to use discretion when allowing vessels to anchor in Yerba Buena. Duhout Sealy builds a tent, just a tent, as the guardhouse, where he also builds boats for his own use, right there on Yerba Buena, boats that he uses to trade, hide and tallow, where he is to use his discretion in allowing boats to anchor. But that discretion became discretionary income because the idea quickly dropped and Yerba Buena doesn't build a custom house until 17 years later in 1844. Yerba Buenans know how they like their business. Under the radar, illicit, and tax-free. We just don't have money for infrastructure enhancements, so there isn't a lot of development happening. But again, that's not indicative of the money that was coming and going from a cove. For Alta California, the era of smuggling starts to end when other countries start producing their own hide and tallow. Americans begin moving to Alta California, like Monterey, Yerba Buena, New Helvetica, Sacramento. So the customers are now local. When the United States takes possession of current-day California in July 1846 in the not very exciting Battle of Yerba Buena, it's no longer illegal to trade with the United States. And the 1848 discovery of gold in the Lower Sierra foothills completely switches everyone's focus. It's interesting to realize Alta California's trading history was born in the 1770s out of absolute necessity between hungry padres and military soldiers. And Spain's inability to support Alta California encouraged foreign ships to trade and therefore smuggle with Californios. From sea otter pelts in 1800 to hide and tallow in the 1820s, Alta California had something the world wanted. And then in 1822, this crazy little startup called McCullough and Hartnell and Company secured an angel investor, the John Begg Trading Company, to disrupt the existing trading structure in Alta California. In 1835, the Pueblo de Yerba Buena was created to support existing clandestine trading coming in and out of the cove, and we made politicians and government officials out of smugglers and bribable customs agents. I started this talk by saying the dot-com boom reminded me of the gold rush. But after doing this research, it seems the hide and tallow trade was California's first gold rush. Yerba Buena was at the right place at the right time for both events. And the art form of smuggling and finding creative ways to get around the rules was just something Yerba Buenans were always naturally good at. I would like to say thank you for listening. This is Monkey Block, retelling forgotten stories from San Francisco's golden past.
It's the enthusiasm, and just this young lady got a, it's like the dog with a rag and won't let go. She had to find all this out, and I'm thrilled. So,
Carlina, do you have a sequel?
I could put one together.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think what a lot of people want to know, because it's you built the foundation for smuggling and illicit trade and factors like need and greed, and you know, I think I'd love to hear what happened next. And so let's talk. We'll have another one. Okay.
All right. We have another question.
Another question.
Just a quick question, Carlina. Did you come across any diaries from this period?
You know what? Yes, and they're on that first one, My Dear Listener in England. If you go to all the way from Cape Wrath, he has transcribed some diaries and letters.
Is his relationship to Hartnell or one of the family members?
To McCullough, Hugh McCullough.
McCullough, so
distant cousin.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that relationship, the McCullough, what he was looking for exactly? What was he researching in his family?
Well, Hugh McCullough is his distant cousin, and he's just done a lot of family research. And when he had just done a search term, hide and tallow, one of my episodes came up.
Okay, so he found you via the internet.
Yeah.
Okay.
How could I access your blog?
Oh, well, let's see here. I just happened to bring cards. It's a podcast.
Podcast.
I brought cards with me today. I'm listed on most podcast publishing sites, but you can also use that code to get to the main site. I have transcriptions of what I say for anyone that's hearing impaired. And I also cite my sources with links. So if you want to check the sources that I use, you can check that out as well.
All right. Any other questions? Bring them up. We hope to see you next month. Thank you.
I have cards. My card.